This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Dara here. When I am not writing about food, what I like to do is take people around and show them how good the food is in the Twin Cities. One of my most latest adventures, it was with Adam Sachs. Adam is a person I adore. He's extremely funny, very smart, one of the country's best food and travel writers. He used to be the editor of Savor for a bunch of years, and I just got to reconnect with him when he was in town in the good old Minneapolis-St. Paul reporting a big feature for Travel and Leisure. And while we were palling around, seeing the town, doing all these things, I got to thinking about the fact that he's very good at parachuting into a city. And I kind of want to talk about this. So Adam Sachs is on the show. We're going to talk about how you get to do this travel writing well. Like, how do you get into a city and know it really fast? Yeah. How do you do it?
Yeah, you have to trust your parachute.
All right. So, Adam Sachs, welcome to the show. We're talking about your travel and leisure thing, but I'm very interested. So you, like, just kind of came into the city's cold, huh?
Well, you know that because you know I showed up. We talked a little bit before I arrived, and you gave me some good guidance and intelligence and ideas. And then you know I didn't know anything when I showed up. So sometimes not knowing anything can be a helpful position to be in when you're looking to write about a place. And sometimes it puts you at an obvious disadvantage. I mean, the problem is, as you know, we don't have unlimited time to settle in and get the lay of the land. Magazine budgets aren't what they used to be, and people want you to parachute in and then gather up your parachute and get out of town, you know, 4 days later. So a lot of it is, you know, we rely on the kindness of friends, we rely on the kindness of colleagues, we rely on the intelligence and output of people sort of covering their hometowns. You know, now it's as much, I think, social media as it is, you know, it used to be local bloggers and journalists and national and international journalists writing, sort of follow up on what you've read about and come and check it out for yourself. But now what's great is you can start researching a place really just through Instagram and start looking at places. You know, you're not going to know whether the people posting about it are people whose tastes and opinions you necessarily trust, but you can use your eyes and look at a place that you find through Instagram and then check it out on, you know, online and see, you know, run it by people like you that you know, and see. So it's just a sort of constant act of kind of triangulation and hoping that you find the right places. Obviously, magazines, as you know, all want, you know, new is good, and so you hit the new places.
But I'm kind of two minds about it, because you can do, you know, you could do all the research in the world, right? I mean, you can sit down in a library, even one of those old-fashioned places with the paper books, and you can.
I've been to one. They're amazing. Yeah,
they're amazing. And then you can read everything about it, but then you don't. Then you're just sort of looking for confirmation of what you've read, or you end up with a laundry list. Because I feel like a good travel piece has a lot of the author in it. Do you agree with that, or you don't agree with that?
I absolutely agree in my case. I mean, in the case of people who write sort of stories that are like the kinds I tend to do. Not because I prefer them. I can't do... I don't have an organized enough mind. I don't do enough preliminary research, and I can't write that kind of, you know, 100 best places or the real kind of roundup places stories. Those can be great to rely on when you're looking, you know, if I'm going somewhere, if I'm going to Minneapolis or Montreal or Mongolia for a weekend or something, I might just want to read a story that doesn't have much of the writer in it, but just has, you know, 10 great places to try, because then it's just service information. I tend to write because I'm self-indulgent and I'm lucky enough to have editors who allow me to do it sometimes. stories that have a little bit more story in them, a little bit more narrative arc. And I think what you need for those, you know this, you do this, but you need a mix of some starting places. You don't want to waste a meal, just like you don't want to waste a meal as a normal citizen on a trip because you don't have a lot of time, by definition, if you're traveling. But then you go from there and you hope that you meet people along the way. You hope that scenes unravel. You hope that people say things that make you think. And either they send you to another place that you wouldn't have known about, or they, you know, put in context their city or their cuisine or their lives in some interesting way that you can kind of piece together into something that turns out to be a story instead of just a kind of list of notable places.
Well, it's complicated because the list of notable places can be helpful and a court can be obstructive, right? So the Minneapolis, I think, is a great example. I was living here for years before I really understood how much milling, like how much the actual Mississippi River turning mill wheels downtown was informed so much of the city, like how much the river was the heart of the city. And that seemed, when I look back on it, you know, how could I not understand that? But then once you know it, it's not that relevant for the day to day. It doesn't help you with the, you know, the good news.
It might inform certain opinions you have, or it's interesting context for, you know, if you're a critic for the local newspaper or magazine or radio. You know, maybe you're just, yeah, you're looking at what's the new pizza place, what's the new taco joint. But your stories become more interesting if you know, the greater depth you have about either the food itself or the people making it or the city itself. I mean, so I think, yeah, ideally, you know, anyone writing one of these stories would have a lot more context, a lot more time. You would both go to the library and, you know, kind of throw yourself into the city and parachute down into a public area and sit on a park bench and wait until someone interesting came along and he talked to you. The danger, I think, is when you're in too much of a rush and you don't have time for any of it. So all you're doing really is kind of echoing, you know, the standard lists that get churned and re-churned and the same places show up every time.
Well, then there's a school of thought of people who like to be more naive, you know, who like to kind of keep themselves from knowing too much and just like to kind of show up and feel, you know, just sort of unmediated.
I don't know if it's a school of thought that I belong to, but it's definitely a sort of personal failing turned into a professional approach. I mean, I just, you know, I think it's hard. I have trouble. I love to travel. I love to eat, obviously. I have trouble reading even, I shouldn't admit this, but even sometimes travel stories, but travel guides in particular or histories of places until I'm kind of on the plane to that place or I'm there already. And sometimes what happens is, because it's almost in the abstract, it's hard to get a feel for it. You just feel like you're reading, you know, a kind of Lonely Planet description of a rough guide description of any neighborhood or any historical site, and then you go and you kind of you feel some connection to the place and you get curious, and so sometimes it's a bit of a, you know, kind of as it's happening scramble to realize that you're there now, you're curious, you wish you knew more. You know, you can do a little bit in retrospect when you get home, you can read about the places, you can kind of, you know, fit the pieces together. But I think ideally, yeah, you would know that it was, you'd know about the milling, you'd know about the cuisine, you'd know about the history of the city, or, you know, best case, I think, for a writer like me, who is, as you say, parachuting in, you find the right people, you find your guides, you know, you find your rabbis along the way and get that intel from them.
Yeah, because the big risk, and we're all mourning Jonathan Gold still, the great Los Angeles critic who I slightly cannot get around to believing is gone. But he talked a lot about how people would write about Los Angeles is like always in this cliched way, right? It would always be like,
right,
City of angels, city of crime and glamour, you know? And the thing about...
Highs and lows. Yeah. The city of contrast.
Yeah.
And much like every other city.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about cliche is that it's like a very easy groove for your mind to get into. And resisting cliche is like very difficult discipline at times. And so you do the research, and sometimes what you come away with the research is like the cliches. It's like, I'm going to see
a bunch of...
It's a cliche
for a reason. It's actually true. You want to push past that. And certainly I think, you know, it's worth talking about. John Nicol is a perfect example of someone who, by nature of being, you know, kind of very invested in a place, in a giant place, in a fascinating place, but a place, he was able to, you know, go way deeper and beyond cliche and really explore a city in ways that you know, people weren't sort of conditioned to explore it. I think the problem sometimes, or the situation for a writer coming into a place, is that, you know, sometimes if you're sending me to Paris, I sort of want the cliche. I'm only there for, you know, a week or two, or however long it is.
Pointy bread,
or whatever it is. I want to live the cliche. I want to feel like I'm in Paris, and I don't necessarily need to know exactly what's changed or what's happening or the most up-to-date version of the food scene or the cultural scene in the way that I would if I lived there and was looking for direction, you know, to sort of take me away from what I already know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think Jonathan Gold is another good example, because he would be the first person to say that even though he spent his entire career doing nothing but kind of casting a spotlight on Los Angeles, you can't know it all. There's no getting to the, you know, there's no period at the end of that exploration. You cannot know all of Los Angeles. But I have now talked to you so much about how to do it and why to do it and the concept about it that I had not asked you. What did you think? What did you come away with in your Travel and Leisure magazine exploration of the Twin Cities? What did you think?
I had a great time. I mean, I have to say embarrassing is the wrong word, but there's slightly, you know, I'm aware that it is slightly funny for a major glossy national travel magazine to come on the scene and sort of declare a big city, two big cities, like the Twin Cities is something, you know, suddenly worthy of our attention. So I was trying not to, you know, act like I had discovered the place, because clearly I hadn't. I'm also, you know, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I travel around a lot, but I'd never been. So it was also, I tried not to make it too much a story of someone who had never been, because that's not all that interesting. You know, the point wasn't me travel writer or me food writer, my first impressions of it. I just tried to give a sense of why people were excited about it, why editors at magazines like Travel and Leisure would be, why it'd be on their radar in a way that maybe it wouldn't have been, you know, a few years ago. And a lot of that is the same for any American eating or travel destination, is that you need some amount of, you know, you need something happening in the food scene that seems exciting. You need some nice hotels to stay at. You need some cool bars. And it kind of all percolates up into this idea that now this is a place that, you know, if you haven't been, it's a good time to go.
All right, let's take a little pause here for some commercials, and we'll come back and drill down to this whole situation with Adam Sachs coming here for Travel and Leisure. What he thinks it's going to be in the magazine. You're getting a sneak peek of what do they think of us now. We'll get more when we come back. We're back with Adam Sachs. I am, as ever, Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl, Minneapolis St. Paul restaurant critic and talker about food, tweeter on the Twitter bot at Dear Dara. You got any questions? Text me or tweet me.
Should I text you? Or
you should tweet me and text me.
Okay.
But
okay.
Not right now. Right now you should say.
Not right now.
All
right.
So you came into Minneapolis and people were interested. Travel and Leisure was like, we are very fancy. We send Adam Sachs to get to the bottom of this. And then what?
You know, your city has arrived.
Yes.
No.
We had been in after our Super Bowl, like we're getting this like left and right. It was like, no, this is what USA Today thinks about us. No, this is what Time Magazine thinks about us. Like, so we're excited that that the really good glossy wants to think about us. But what were your impressions? How are we different from, you know, a sharp stick in the eye or whatever? What's
much preferable to a sharp stick in the eye? No, this is where we were just talking before the break about cliche. So now you are setting me up to fall directly into the trap of cliche. But I mean, I think one of the obvious pleasures of coming to the Twin Cities is the range of what you can have. You can go and have Korean influence pizza, and that's really great pizza just on its own terms, and then go to the Mon Market, and then you can have Southernish barbecue in St. Paul, and you can wander around in these. You can have great cheese and fermented stuff at Gist Fermentation, and it just seems like it's what I want from a dining destination city, that there's enough that's sort of peculiar and local and feels like you're somewhere particular, and there's enough just to sort of make you could fill a week of eating easily. So no, I really enjoyed myself, obviously.
Yeah, the somewhere particular, that is, I feel like, one of them in the 21st century. We had this, I found it very annoying, barbecue covering the city last year. It was like people had just been reading so many issues of Texas Monthly that everyone was like, you know what we need? More brisket. And, six brisket places popped open and then five closed, But it was for a little while. It was like, what are we trying to do here? We're going to be Austin? Like, I'm all happy for Austin, Texas to continue to be Austin, Texas. But, like, that's not us. What are we doing?
I think it's an interesting question. And the way you feel about it is different, I think, when you put on your critic or writer hat, and different from what you would feel just as a diner. I mean, listen, if I'm traveling to Paris to write about, Parisian food, I don't want to go to the taco place. But if I'm living in Paris, maybe, and I can't make it to a place where there are real tacos, I'd be happy to have one, in my neighborhood. So
yeah, the Tex-Mex restaurants of Paris are bizarre. They are just...
Not a story I hope to ever have to be assigned or investigate, but if there's a mini kind of infiltration of barbecue in the Twin Cities, maybe it's not meant to be. Maybe it's not the you're not Austin, as you say, but if you're living there, maybe it's something you're into, and maybe some of it will stick, and maybe something of how it's done, the context of the way it's done, or the personalities behind it will somehow be local, something, either the ingredients or the approach, or just a kind of riffing out in a way that is sort of joyously non-authentic will create something
that did cool exactly way. Happen. Like, we ended up with, one out of the five, half a dozen stuck around, and that, attaches to a person and a passion, and it will, I think, grow. And the place I'm thinking of is called Q Fanatic. Spectacular place. There's a little one down by 62 and 35 where they meet together, if you know the Twin Cities.
What was the local sort of take that they found?
I think it just really attaches to a person. It's the guy who runs it, and he has a passion for it, and he's committed to making potato chips every day and doing the hard work of getting there, in the wee hours of the morning. And we do have other things. Like, I'm thinking about this great Japanese, Zenbox Izakaya, which is downtown Minneapolis. And it's a genuinely, Japanese drinking bar with great ramen. But that's because of the owners, John and Lena, and they are just really committed to their Japanese. They're committed to doing that. They give their heart and soul to the place, and it works.
Right. So it's not, they're not trying to fuse the cuisines or the ingredients of Minneapolis with the Japanese izakaya approach. They're just sort of making their version of it, and it pleases you. And I think that's a completely, that's authentic in that it's people doing stuff they love, and it shows. And I think that's the kind of thing you're definitely looking for as a diner when you live somewhere. I think sometimes when you travel, you do, I did find myself asking people sort of what is a Minneapolis, or what is a St. Paul dish, or what is a Minneapolis St. Paul feel in a restaurant? And that was a little bit elusive, but I think that's true for...
So I was going to ask you what they said, because that's been kind of elusive for me for...
sometimes it was, I think, Sammy at Grand Catch, when we were having lunch, I was asking him if things had changed in the last 10 years, and he was talking about, Vietnamese restaurants using, is it I'm going to mess it up. Is it pike perch or what's the
walleye? Yeah.
This isn't live. You can fix that. I'm just making sound like I know what I'm saying. But, you know, it's something like that where you're having people using ingredients that would have previously otherwise been used for sort of more, you know, what we think of as Midwestern, maybe, you know, Scandinavian influence cuisine, and then they're applying it to the stuff they're cooking, which is cool and is particular and is, you know, legitimately sort of a local thing. I didn't get a sense. I didn't go and eat, you know, some of the things that I think are kind of like when the football came to town, maybe people were doing lists of places to go, you know, bars to eat at and certain sort of dishes you could get. I wasn't trying to sort of do a roundup of regional specialties. I was just sort of curious to find out if people had a feeling about it. I mean, you and I went to Pig Ate My Pizza. Is that
Pig Ate My Pizza up in Robbinsdale? Yeah, that's
obviously not an Italian place, and it's not a pizza place I think you would find in many other cities. It had, I think, through its sort of earnestness and enthusiasm and weirdness, a kind of, you know, what felt like a very particular thing. I don't know if it's particularly something that you could only find in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but it felt.
Here's my thesis. I think it is. It's because there's a thread that goes through the Twin Cities where we like eccentricity. I'm thinking about Prince. I'm thinking about Jesse Ventura. I'm thinking about like you.
I'm drawing a line between Prince, Jesse Ventura, and Pig Ate My Pizza.
Yeah, I mean, it's just there's something about a Minnesotan that looks at that. First of all, there's a Minnesotan that just marches to the beat of their own drummer, and then there's something about the community here that looks at someone marching to the beat of their own drummer and is like, I like it. I'll support that, and that's one of the things I love about here.
Yeah. Now, when we were there, people seemed very happy with their, you know, wine spritz pizza and their cloche covered smoked pizza and their, you know, things that would make an Italian, you know, kind of faint, but felt very, I don't know, it felt true to itself in that it was, yeah, like I said, it definitely marched to a beat of its own drummer, and it was fun to see that it didn't seem like a cynical crowd or anyone waiting to be impressed. People seemed happy. People seemed, you know, amused and into it.
Yes, I think that's very accurate. All right, so I got to ask you for some tips, because that would be a shame to let you go without them. So if someone is listening to this, they want to travel like you do. They want to be like a person who goes and comes away from a city with a story, comes away with a unique experience. Well, I know you go to other cities.
Yeah.
What do you, how do you do that? I'm going to Portland next week, so maybe you can give me some tips. How can I come out of Portland, Oregon, with a deeper understanding than I would get just from what I might commonly do?
I think it's about this sort of triangulating your sources and your you know, through Instagram, through the magic of hashtags and just sort of seeing what kind of bubbles up, you can track down some things that maybe you wouldn't have heard about firsthand from people you know. You talk to, you know, find chefs who you trust in places. One of the things I've found is that, this is not fair as a blanket statement, but I think it's true, I think people would admit it, if you talk to them about it, is that chefs don't get to see them. The nature of their work is that they are in the kitchen a lot. They don't get to travel that much. Sometimes they don't even get to eat in their city as much as they would.
Sometimes they don't even eat in their own restaurants as much as.
Not that they don't want to. They just don't have time. But, you know, chefs sometimes aren't, I think, as good a kind of guide to cities as we would hope they would be, just because they don't have time to try as many places. But I think, you know, you talk to them, see what they've heard about, see where they've been wanting to try. Obviously, if there are writers, bloggers, journalists and critics in places that you can reach out to and see what they've been reviewing. If you know them, ask them what they're into. And I think you get a sense of, you know, when names of places show up, you know, a lot, you can get a sense that it's worth checking out. And also what appeals to you. I mean, I think, again, if you're any, you know, two people would have different needs coming out of a visit to Portland or St. Paul or anywhere. So if you if you're looking for things that are, you know, very particular to a place, then I think it's worth pressing and finding those, even if they're sometimes, you know, they're not the things that people who live there are that interested in. It could be fun to just try a dish. You know, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I probably had burgoo twice in my life. But if someone was going to Louisville, maybe it's worth seeking it out because, you know, it's something you can't have if you're from anywhere else. So I think thinking about, you know, finding out what people are talking about, but also thinking about what you'd like to do. What would you enjoy in a place? And then finding the story there.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna find out. I want to see some of those big trees. That's on my list.
big
trees in the ocean. Those are my, you know, those big Pacific rainforests. I haven't spent any time in a place like that in a long time.
Okay, this isn't a food story then. Don't eat the trees.
I will, and I hear they're soft serve, but that's silly. I'm going to get some. Apparently, they're very have advanced soft serve cone shells. That's what I hear is happening.
New cone technology.
New that, you know, like that freezer, like you dip the cone and then it's hard on the outside of soft serve. Are you familiar with that in your elite life? Oh, well.
No, I love this, but like.
It's called a shell. That's the word I've been groping
magic
for.
Shell.
Magic,
it's like
shell.
Magic shell. But it's like an updated magic shell.
Yes.
This is exciting.
I am excited. So.
See, this is what I do. I just wait around and someone will interview me and give away the secret.
All right. Well, everybody, go pick up the Travel and Leisure with the Minneapolis St. Paul story on it. Well, now you know how the sausage got made. Adam Sachs.
How the magic shell is made.
Thank you so much. This is just delightful. I love talking to you.
Thank you.
We'll do it again.
Talk to you soon.
All right.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Bye. All right, when we come back on Off the Menu, I'm going to have some kohlrabi recipes for you. We're back. Yeah, I was talking to Adam Sachs about his story in Travel and Leisure, their August issue. It is on the stands. I love finding out about this stuff. Very interesting. All right, but I also love looking at the farmer's market tables and seeing kohlrabi. So you know kohlrabi, right? It's the big knobby root. It looks like an alien. I never really saw it before I moved to Minneapolis, but I am a fan now. If you've never had it, it's a relative of cabbage. It's kind of almost like a jicama or a pear, like an Asian pear, like very crunchy. There's some science into it. All of these things that are related to cabbages are extremely healthy. I thought of doing it for the recipes this week because a friend of mine put a picture of it up on Twitter. It was like, what is it? I bought this on a lark. I was like, oh, I know what that is. It's kohlrabi. And you should love it. It's very good. So here are the recipes. They are up at WCCORadio.com, WCCORadio.com/menu or WCCORadio.com/Dara. They're all up there. Number 5 is a kohlrabi and radish Vietnamese-style slaw. So if you grate kohlrabi, you take it, you grate it up on a grater, box grater, it just has this really nice crunchy texture. It holds dressing really well. It can kind of substitute in for daikon or something like that, a little bit milder. The recipe that I'm putting up for a Vietnamese-style slaw, you know, it's got a little vinegar, a little cilantro. Really good. You can put it on a ham sandwich and make a banh mi substitute pretty easily. That's good. All right, my number 4 recipe for kohlrabi. It's a cabbage that looks like an alien. It's a shaved kohlrabi with apple and hazelnuts. So, you know, there's something about it that just goes with that hazelnut flavor just so beautifully. And so that is my other recipe. Another one I got is a Swedish kohlrabi salad with new potatoes and dill. So just about anywhere that cabbage grows, kohlrabi grows. And so, of course, it grows in Sweden. They like to do it with a dill, of course, and new potatoes, the little ones. I've seen them all over the farmers markets right now. And you can bring this to a potluck. It's a good potluck salad. All right. So what about a bright purple coleslaw? This one with walnuts and kohlrabi. This has caraway seeds too, so you're going in that kind of German direction. Really delicious. So that's a purple coleslaw. And then the final thing that I recommend if you're a kohlrabi newbie, you've never had it before, you're a little bit intimidated, just peel it, cut it into sticks, you know, just crunchy like carrot sticks, just sticks that you can crunch on. And then just, do you ever get that that Mexican fruit seasoning they call salsa en polvo or tajine? So it's just kind of, you know, chili pepper, salt, little lime juice powder. If you can put that on your kohlrabi sticks, maybe serve it with watermelon on the side, that is a nice summer day. So that's what I got. Got all our kohlrabi tips. Those are up at WCCORadio.com. Coming back, I will answer your questions. Got anything for me? Ask me anything. You can tweet me at Dear Dara, or you can text us 81807. Dara here. We're back. Got a question. Who were we talking to? That was Adam Sachs from Travel and Leisure talking about his Minneapolis St. Paul story. That's on the stands now. All right. So first question I got is Kathy texted in. She wants to know about good ideas for something to bring in the car to cabin. It's like a 6-hour drive. They need to feed tons of people and yet no refrigeration. Oh, Kathy, that is a complicated list of things. Well, I think that, you know, obviously you probably thought of this already, but anything that's in the cake, bread pudding, you know, brownie situation. But I think you're looking more in an entree. And if I had to bring in something that didn't get refrigerated, you know what? How about this? Why don't you make a giant muffaletta sandwich? So get a whole loaf of focaccia bread or a couple of them, stuff it full of everything, the hams, the salami, the olive relish, all that good stuff, wrap it up in foil, and then it just gets better if it just kind of sits around. So I think I put sandwiches for boat trips and cabin trips on the, I'll see if we can get those kind of resurfaced. I put those out a couple weeks ago, and I think any of those would be good. I like maybe an oil-cured tuna sandwich, too, and a baguette. That gets better. You could do that. A bunch of sandwiches that get better over time, a kind of fancy one, so people know you're fancy. Ugh, are we out of time? I think we are. Next week, we've got the chef from one of the best French spots in town. That would be Dustin Thompson from Saint Genevieve. So how do you cook French food that is relevant to the farm-driven trend, happy Minneapolis of today? We will find out. Till then, may your coleslaw stay crisp and your understanding stay flexible. And I will see you here next week on Off the Menu.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.